let's begin.
My father's family home was just a little under 2 hours away by car from where we lived, a small village surrounded by farmland. I often stayed with my grandparents during my summer vacation and winter breaks from school, and they were always happy to play with me. But the last time I visited them was over 10 years ago now, when I was still in my third year of high school. It was my spring break, and I had been invited to visit, and since the weather was good, I rode my bike out to their house. After I got there, I was a little cold, so I stretched out for a moment in a warm, sunny spot off the road. Then I heard something strange. Popo, po-popo, po, popo. It wasn't a mechanical noise. It sounded strange, but human. I looked about to see where the noise was coming from and saw a white hat peeking over the top of the hedge. The hat moved along to a break in the hedge when I could see that it was being worn by a woman with a white dress. She had to be tall, though. The hedge was over 2 meters high, 6 feet. Before I could really think about this much, the woman was gone, seemingly disappeared. The strange sound was gone, too. At the time, I just guessed that the person's apparent height had been due either to wearing very tall platform shoes or that it had been a man dressed up like a woman. Odd, but that was all. A little later, while having tea with Grandma and Grandpa, I mentioned the strange person I had seen and that I thought it was a transvestite. But when, as an afterthought, I also mentioned the strange po-po-po noise, my grandparents panicked. My grandpa suddenly showered me with questions. When did you see this? How much taller than the fence? Did they look at you? I answered as quickly as he asked. Then he rushed to the phone in the hallway, shutting the sliding door so I couldn't hear the call. The room was suddenly very quiet. Grandma smiled a little, but was trembling for some reason. Grandpa came back soon and told me I would be staying overnight with them. I had to admit that I didn't understand what the fuss was about and asked what was so bad about the strange woman. Grandpa said, "Grandma can tell you." He then looked at her and said he was going to pick up someone named K-san, Mr. or Mrs. K, and then left. In a clearly shaky voice, Grandma said, "It seems that Hachishaku-sama has become interested in you, but we shouldn't worry. Grandpa is making arrangements." Grandma then told me, a little at a time, that Hachishaku-sama was not a person. She was some sort of monster named Hachishaku-sama because of her height. 8 shaku, Japanese foot, about 11.9 inches, tall. Hachi, 8. Shaku, foot. Sama, person. Her appearance could change somewhat, sometimes young, sometimes old, but she would always be abnormally tall and would always have a creepy laugh. Po po po. Once Hachishaku-sama took an interest in a person, they were hunted to death in just a few days, and the last known victim of Hachishaku-sama had been 15 years previous. I learned later that Hachishaku-sama was supposed to be trapped in a shrine near the village, having been sealed in by 4 statues of Jizo, a protective deity of children, each placed to the north, south, east, and west of the structure. The village had some sort of agreement with its neighboring villages, wherein they were given some advantages to make up for the fact they had to watch over the monster. For example, they got first priority on water use. Since it had been over 12 years since Hachishaku-sama had killed anyone, I have to wonder if the old men in those villages thought it was still a good arrangement. At the time, I couldn't quite believe what I was being told, of course, but then Grandpa returned with a very old lady. K-san, for that's who it was, handed me a small paper charm and told me to hold on to it. Then she and Grandpa went upstairs. While they were upstairs, I tried to excuse myself to use the bathroom. But my grandma wouldn't let me go alone, and she insisted on keeping the door open and an eye on me as I was using the facilities. This is when I started to really understand just how serious my grandparents felt the situation was. I was soon led upstairs to a bedroom. The single window in the room had been covered with newspaper.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
On which a charm like the one I was holding had been affixed. In each corner was a small pile of Mauricio, sacred salt, and they had also set up a small wood box with a statue of Buddha on it. I was told I would have to stay in the room until 7 the next morning, and that I couldn't leave no matter what. They provided a bucket for me to potty in. Grandpa made it clear that neither he nor Grandma would talk to me until 7 the next morning. Kaysan told me to keep the charm on me and to pray to the Buddha if I got scared. I had a bed and a TV in the room. Grandma had left me snacks. I tried to watch some TV but couldn't pay attention. I wasn't hungry either. So I just lay on the bed, wrapped in the sheets, and eventually fell asleep, because the next thing I remember was waking up to a late-night show on the TV. My watch said it was around 1 a.m., and I heard something tapping on the glass of the window. I tried to ignore it. It was very persistent. I had some tea and a snack and turned up the TV to drown out the tapping. Then I heard Grandpa call from the hall, "Are you all right? It's okay to come out if you're too scared." I started for the door automatically, but stopped myself as I remembered how insistent Grandpa had been that he wouldn't talk to me until 7. Again, I heard him. "It's okay. Come here." I wanted it to be my grandpa's voice, but somehow it wasn't. I suddenly had goosebumps all over me. Then I noticed the salt in the corner. It was becoming darker. I dropped in front of the Buddha, clasping the charm in both hands, and started praying for help. Popopo, po, popo. The tapping on the window started again, louder than before, more insistent. Then a definite hand slapped the window, despite the fact I was on the second floor. I did the only thing I could. I kept praying to Buddha. It was a long night. I really don't remember much other than praying until I heard the news on the TV. I looked over, and the morning clock on the news screen showed it was 7:13 a.m. Garth note, all Japanese TV channels show the time on screen during morning programs. The tapping had stopped. The voice was gone. The salt in the corners was almost black. I gingerly opened the door. Grandma and Kaysan, both looking worried, were there. Grandma, in tears, told me things were going to be okay. Downstairs, I found my father waiting. Grandpa came in from outside, and we needed to drive off. Outside, I found there was a number of men standing around near a van. My grandpa's car was in front of the van, and my father's was behind it. I was seated in the middle of the van, with 8 of the men sitting around me, 1 to each side, and then 3 in front and 3 in back. One more man took the driver's seat, and Kaysan took the passenger side of the front. I was told to keep my eyes closed and my face pointing down. "You are the only one who can see Hachishaku-sama. Don't look at her." Our convoy started off slowly at first. I don't think we had even traveled 20 kilometers before Kaysan warned us things were about to get hard. Then she started to chant phrases that sounded Buddhist. And then I heard the laugh again. Popopo, po, pop, popopo. I clutched the charm to my chest and kept my head down, but couldn't resist a quick peek at the window. That was a mistake. I could see a white dress. It appeared stationary to the car's window, even though we had to be moving very fast at that point. The figure moved as if to lower its head to the window, and I gasped. And the man next to me told me to shut my eyes, which I did, and tightly. Though no one else could see Hachishaku-sama, they all heard what happened next. The tapping. I don't know how, but the tapping started on every window in the van, all at the same time. I don't know how long it lasted, but Over time, it faded. Kaysan had stopped chanting by that time as well, and eventually said that she felt we were now safe, so the cars all pulled over. My father and Grandpa thanked all the men who had assisted. As it turned out, all of them were related to me. Grandpa and Kaysan had hoped to confuse Hachishaku-sama by surrounding me with many people of the same bloodline. I had to stay overnight while Grandpa was gathering my kinsmen, and it was deemed safer to try to escape during the day than the night. Kaysan asked me to show her the charm, which I had forgotten I was still holding. It had turned almost entirely black. Kaysan commented, "It should be all right now, but just in case." And with that, she handed me a new charm to hold until I got home. I drove home with my father. During the drive, he told me that one of his friends when he was young had been taken by Hachishaku-sama. Grandpa and the neighbors delivered my bike back to me later. In talking to my grandpa over the phone, I've confirmed that it was not his voice I heard outside the room that night, which sent shivers down my spine again. Hachishaku-sama targets teens and children. So if the monster speaks with a familiar relative's voice, the victim would normally come to it willingly. I'd almost forgotten this all after 10 years. Grandma called to tell me that one of the Jizo statues that had sealed Hachishaku-sama into the shrine looked as if it had been broken by someone. The statue that was broken lined up with the road leading to our home. 2 years ago, my grandpa died. Sadly, I was not allowed to attend his funeral. I try to tell myself it was all superstition, but sometimes I still hear that voice call, Popopo.
Let's begin.
Long ago, in the pre-Civil War era, South Carolina's landscape was adorned with plantations of diverse sizes. My story involves a relatively humble plantation facing economic challenges in the aftermath of the war. While grand plantations thrived, this one grappled to stay afloat. To adapt, a pivotal shift occurred, transforming from a rice plantation to fields rustling with pine trees. The once vibrant rice fields made way for a pine tree farm, meeting the wartime demand for pine box coffins. Eventually, nicknamed Pine Box Plantation, it, like many southern plantations, closed down, left abandoned, and succumbed to decay. Over the decades, whispers of otherworldly influence enveloped its closure, turning it into the town's local folklore, a house that urged passersby to hasten their pace. In my town, it became a repository of eerie tales, from phantom music and flickering lights to ghostly figures. The narratives ignited the curiosity of local youth, leading to dares and midnight misadventures. Since childhood, I was captivated by the campfire stories about this house. Tales of a headless Confederate soldier patrolling on a full moon and the tragic suicide of the plantation owner's wife and her screams that echoed through the night. Yet the funny part is that Pine Box Plantation's haunting label isn't rooted in tragedy. No deaths, wars, or suicides have ever occurred on the property. My grandfather, a no-nonsense man, shared a unique perspective on the plantation with me once he said, "I don't rightly believe in that sort of thing, but I reckon that some places feel haunted, not because bad things happen there, but because they attract bad things. But either way, I find that most things that fall in either category are best left to themselves." As summer approached, my friends and I eagerly planned to explore Pine Box Plantation, fueled by our fascination with the supernatural. However, the town was thrust into chaos when our schoolmate, Tommy Green, went missing. The mystery halted our plans as the town entered a lockdown, with streets adorned with flyers featuring Tommy's smiling face beneath his green gator's hat. The adults were unnerved by how he vanished without a trace, from his yard 1 minute to gone the next. No sound, no witnesses, no Tommy. Months later, as we finally gained the freedom to spend a night together, we knew it was now or never. Yet, the challenge lay in navigating the thick overgrowth that had transformed the plantation's land into a massive pine forest. Sneaking out in the middle of the night and biking the 8 miles to the property were the easy parts. The real obstacle was the dense brush that rendered walking impossible. The only way to reach the property was by taking a boat through the sizable lake that bordered the back of the house. For this venture, we devised a plan, admittedly a bit foolish, yet a plan nonetheless. Armed with 2 canoes, courtesy of my buddy, we ingeniously affixed ropes to both the front and rear, strategically securing our bikes with 1 rider at the front left and another at the rear right. We embarked on our journey in this peculiar formation, surprisingly finding it manageable after mastering the art of compensating for the weight-induced leans. A few minor scuffs marked our path, but the real revelation hit us upon reaching the lake. My buddy had failed to mention that both canoes were designed for single occupants. The scenario unfolded as such. 1 man anchored in the seat, methodically orchestrating the rowing, while his companion straddled the back, clinging to the rower as if life itself depended on it, a desperate dance to avoid capsizing. Yet, like our earlier cycling expedition, once attuned to the delicate equilibrium of weight distribution, the Endeavour revealed itself as surprisingly manageable. Of course, the occasional plunge into the water added a splash of unpredictability. But with 1 guy momentarily submerged, we still considered it an achievement, effortlessly retrieving him from the lake and back onto the canoe. We slowly navigated our canoes to the lake's shore, adjoined to the backyard of the plantation. We secured our boats by pulling them all the way out the water and on the yard to assure they weren't swept away. And then we all turned to just look at it. It was the first time any of us had seen it this up close before. Amidst the towering pines, an ancient plantation house stood frozen in time, its once majestic facade weathered and weary. Ivy vines clung desperately to the time-worn bricks, as if nature itself sought to reclaim what man had long forsaken. The creaking gate, rusted and barely hanging on, whispered tales of forgotten elegance. As my gaze swept across the decaying grandeur, the surrounding pine forest cast long shadows, wrapping the estate in an eerie embrace. The air carried a hushed symphony of wind rustling through pine needles, blending with the distant murmur of the lake. Windows, shattered by the passage of time, revealed secrets now exposed to the elements. From the porch, where splintered floorboards protested each hesitant step, the view unfolded, a breathtaking panorama of the expansive lake, its waters reflecting the melancholy sky above. A silence enveloped the scene, broken only by the haunting echoes of a bygone era. The air held the weight of history, and the once vibrant plantation now stood as a spectral sentinel, guarding the memories etched into its weathered walls. We were broken out of our lost gazing by thunderous bang that came from somewhere in the house. We all jumped and then locked eyes without words. We knew we were all terrified, but had exhausted too much effort to turn back now. After all, this is what we came for, to see if the stories were true. Venturing into the house proved effortless, given the absence of a door. The interior exuded a pungent amalgamation of earth and mold, cloaked in darkness and dampness. Stripped bare, the dwelling stood hollow, devoid of furniture or any remnants of its former inhabitants. Surprisingly, the imposing aura dissipated within the confines of its dilapidated walls, contrasting sharply with the ominous grandeur witnessed from the backyard. Room after room, we roamed aimlessly, looking for nothing but expecting something. The master bedroom, an expansive room, held our attention, an attention promptly grasped by the sight of an unexpected object, a coffin. A collective freeze overcame us as a haunting voice rose in my mind, reminding me of our desires turned reality. Approaching the coffin with cautious steps, our anxiety gave way to bewilderment as we discovered its lid missing, revealing a disconcerting interior harboring only an aged sleeping bag and a dingy pillow. Perplexed by this incongruity, our gaze was drawn to another peculiar discovery. A pile of clothing, ranging from old to new, most of it children's attire. The presence of a familiar green gator's hat jolted us collectively backward. Tommy Green. Amidst our disconcertion, a scraping sound reverberated from outside the house, originating near the location of our abandoned canoes. Our collective rush outdoors, entangled and stumbling, led us to the lake's shore, where the canoes had vanished without a trace. A stark realization dawned. They couldn't have simply drifted away. Panic set in as we dispersed, frantically searching for the missing canoes, and that's when my eyes caught sight of a lone tin boat conspicuously nestled in the tree line beyond the lakeshore. A disconcerting truth unveiled itself. We were not alone. Label me a less than stellar friend, but without hesitation, I plunged into the dark waters of the lake, determined to reach my bike. The realization dawned swiftly upon my friends, evidenced by the successive splashes echoing behind me. 1, 2, 3. Then, an unsettling fourth splash sent my stomach plummeting and coiling into knots. Every stroke through the water felt like a desperate race against impending dread. Exerting every ounce of strength, I swam with a fervor that threatened to rupture my heart from my chest. Reaching my bike, I clambered aboard, a silent prayer on my lips as I anxiously awaited my friends. Miraculously, one by one, they surfaced, scrambling out of the water and onto their bikes. We pedaled furiously, as if outrunning the devil himself, racing back to my buddy's house with an urgency that took no care for potential trouble. Upon waking my friend's parents, we spilled everything: the coffin, the vanished canoes, the tin boat, and most crucially, Tommy's hat. The police combed the property meticulously, corroborating our account by uncovering the coffin, the boat, and the hat. The authorities said it seemed like someone had been squatting on the property for a while. Yet, Tommy wasn't found, and no arrests were made in connection to his inexplicable disappearance. To this day, his disappearance remains a mystery, as does the Pine Box explanation. In the end, I learned that day that monsters are real, and perhaps ghosts. Just because a place is called haunted, it doesn't mean by the dead.
Thank you for being here, when you have so many other options.
Fall's here, and so are incredible sales at Tanger Outlets. Find must-have handbags, footwear, and all the latest fall arrivals, all at unbeatable savings. Shop top brands like Nike Factory, Crocs, J. Crew Factory, Coach, Gap Factory, Old Navy Outlet, Under Armour, and even more brands you love. Save more every time you shop with deals up to 70% off. Tanger Outlets, always on trend, always on sale. Plan your trip at tanger.com.